Well, over the next weeks leading up to Easter, and of course at Easter, we'll be particularly focusing on the central event of Christianity, which is the cross. Now, our intention is always to be focused on the cross in church, week by week, because Jesus is the central figure of the universe, and the central activity of Jesus was the activity of the cross. It's always our hope and intention that week by week, everything we do is coloured by the work of Jesus on the cross. It's the foundation for it. It's the backdrop. It's the aim to which we're heading to understand. It's the heartbeat. It's the colour. It's just that these weeks, particularly, the parts of the Bible we're looking at do record for us a compilation of the eyewitness accounts of what actually happened when Jesus was crucified. And they are, for us, therefore, a particularly focused attention on this event. Now, I start by saying all this just to remind you of how significant these parts of the Bible are. We are not just looking at another part in the story of the life of Jesus. We are looking at the central part. You know, the gospel itself. There are four gospels in the New Testament, four accounts of the life of Jesus. Now, think with me about Luke's account for a moment. Luke has 24 chapters in it. Go home and look at it later. 24 chapters. Chapter 19 is the point at which Jesus arrives in Jerusalem in the last week of his life. By the end of that week, he is crucified. Now, chapter 19, chapter 24, five chapters, call it six to make the maths work. Six chapters out of 24 are devoted to the last week of Jesus' life. A quarter of the whole book is recounting what happens in that very serious and massive moment of Jesus being condemned to death. Now, why is that? Well, because the crucifixion is monumental. And in fact, the whole gospel, when you start reading it from the beginning part is a few chapters on the birth of Jesus, but even there is the anticipation of the horror of the cross. Mary is told that her heart will be pierced. Her son will be a saviour, but there will be death and destruction. All of that's anticipated. On the bulk of the letter, the bulk of the gospel, Jesus speaks numbers of times through the gospel about his impending death. He says to his disciples as they're travelling towards Jerusalem that when we get to Jerusalem, I'll be betrayed, given it over to the hands of sinners. I'll be tortured, crucified, killed, and then rise. Jesus tells them a number of times. The whole gospel is this undercurrent of the death of Jesus is coming. And then the bulk of the letter, the book, is focused on his crucifixion. Now, that is the case for all the gospels. In fact, it's more evident in the other gospels. And it's been so evident that people have said the gospels are actually an account of the death of Jesus with an introduction. So central is this thing. It's so important to recognize this. The Bible is obsessed with the cross. And to be a biblical church, to be a church, therefore, that is shaped by the Bible with its balance and its focus, means that we as a church will be a cross-focused church. And it means we as Christians will be cross-focused Christians. So that we spend time on this event over the next weeks is totally appropriate and wonderful. But weird. But really weird, if you think about it. You remember Christianity. Christianity is to be cross-focused. I say that and you're going to go, oh yeah, that sounds pretty good. But just remember, the cross was an ancient form of execution, the most barbaric way of killing a person. Think like gas chamber. So when I say that Christianity is to be cross-focused, you could readily say, in another context, we're talking about a religion that needs to be gas chamber-focused, centred on the gas chamber. Now, I talk about a religion that's focused on the gas chamber, and you kind of go, ugh, that's macabre, that's ghoulish, that's negative. Well, that is exactly the tone you're meant to pick up when I say cross-focused, focused on an ancient instrument of torture. Now, that's kind of weird. Well, it's to be cross-focused, not because we are to be about torture or instruments of torture, But because of the fact that what happened on that instrument of torture, what happened back then on that cross, forever changed the significance of that instrument of torture in human history. So that for us to now talk about the cross, it's impossible to do it without reflecting on what happened on it that moment centuries ago. And to reflect on that cross and what happened on it reveals very deep truths about us, about our world, about our life, about God, about Jesus. And it's my hope that we will actually be drawn to see some of those reflections tonight as we do look at the event of the cross. So let's look at it together. Luke 23, grab your Bibles, open it up. We're going to be picking it up from verse 26, which is kind of lobbing right in the middle of a series of events that are happening. We heard from them, some of them last week. But to put you in the context, Jesus is kind of situated around, we're talking early Friday morning, AD 33. Early Friday morning, AD 33. Now, there are some who might suggest it's AD 30. I think the evidence runs towards it must be AD 33. But whether it's one or the other, the historicity of the crucifixion of Jesus is without doubt. There are other ancient authors, contemporary authors, that are not in the Bible that speak about the crucifixion of Jesus under Pontius Pilate. Give us that kind of detail. So a man called Tacitus, a man called Josephus and others speak about the crucifixion of Jesus. It's a fact of history, and we date it around, well, we date it at 33 AD on Friday the 3rd of April. It's possible to be that precise. Very early that morning, the small hours, it's been dark. Jesus has gone through a harrowing night of betrayal, desertion, torture, beating, and then a trial by Jewish leaders and Roman leaders, and then the suffering of total rejection by the people, his people. And now the verdict has been passed. Pilate, verse 24, has decided to grant the people's demand, and so he's released one man and handed Jesus over to the will of those that want him crucified. And so we hit verse 26. The soldiers are now, we're told, leading him away to the place of execution. And the note there, halfway through verse 26, of Simon, you see mentioned there Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country. He was a pilgrim coming into Jerusalem for the festival. He is made to carry Jesus' cross to the place of execution. Now, that fits entirely the historical context. It was typically the case, we understand historically, that a condemned criminal who was going to be crucified would be made to carry his own cross to the place of execution. And in this context, it makes perfect sense given the night that Jesus has had, where he hasn't slept all the way through, he's been beaten and so on and so forth. It makes sense that he simply can't carry it. And so they're press-ganged in another man to carry it for him, Simon, who carries it for Jesus to the place where he'll be executed. You get that described for us in verse 33. Notice it there. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified Jesus there, along with criminals, one on his right and the other on his left. Now, the place called the Skull, that's the translation of a Greek word, cranium, where we get cranium from, which is the head, the skull cap, cranium. And the Greek word, the place was called that because it looked like the top part of a skull. The hill was shaped like that. And incidentally, if this is of some interest, that word cranium, when it's translated into English, is skull. But when it was translated into Latin, it was translated by the word Calvary. So if you've ever heard the language of Calvary, that's where it comes from. It's the Latin word for the place where Jesus was crucified, the cranium, which we call the skull. Jesus is taken there and he is crucified. Now on the way there, back to verse 27, a large number of people were following him. And I take it this large number of people were the same group of people, by and large, that were there calling out for his crucifixion in verse 21. Crucify him, crucify him. This group of people are following Jesus. It includes women who mourned and wailed for him. Now, it's probably the case that these women are wailing and crying for the sense of injustice that has gone on, possibly. But what's important to note is verse 28 and Jesus' reaction to them. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women and the wombs that have never borne and the breasts that have never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and the hills, 'Cover us.'" Jesus says to them, "Don't weep for me." His reaction is the complete reverse of sharing their concern about him. It's no self-pity in Jesus, not in the slightest. He sees with larger eyes the greater sweep of history and the events that are moving towards into the future. And he says, "You are weeping over me when if you knew your own future, you would be in horror at it. The time is coming," Jesus is saying effectively, "when you will suffer worse than has ever happened. And you will be saying the blessed ones, the ones who don't have children. And you'll be crying out for the mountains to protect you by falling on you." Now, what is Jesus talking about? Well, it's almost certainly a reference to events that were to happen within a few decades at a time, AD 70. 70 AD. We're talking 33 AD, some decades later, 70 AD. Now, if you know anything about your history, that'll be an obvious date for you because it is a significant date in history when an incredible massacre occurred. Just a few years before that, the Jewish people rebelled against Rome, threw them off, and the Romans sent their armies. They laid siege to Jerusalem, and the community of people trapped in Jerusalem were trapped there for some considerable time, and it was dreadful. We have contemporary historians, Josephus, who speak about these events, and it was so dreadful. The starvation was rife, disease was rife. It was so bad, we're told, they cannibalized their infants to survive. Finally, when the Romans broke the walls, they massacred the population. They slaughtered people throughout the city that were there. And we understand that the percentage of the population slaughtered was one of the highest proportions of any city besieged at any time in history. It was a horrendous, horrific time. And do you get what's happening here? Jesus goes, "I know this because I'm the Lord of history. I rule time and I know what is in your future. I am in total control." This event now, he says to the daughters of Jerusalem, is happening to me because I'm allowing it to happen. I'm willing it to happen. It's the divine will of my Father, Luke chapter 22, verse 22. You see right here an instance where this Jesus is no victim of circumstances. You see, too, evidence of this great rule of Jesus in verse 34, where Luke records for us only one set of words that Jesus speaks from the cross. There are a number of others, but Jesus speaks these words from the cross as they're crucifying. He says, "Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing. They don't know that they are crucifying the Lord of life. Forgive them." This group that is crucifying Jesus, that has beaten Jesus, that's tortured Jesus, that's betrayed Jesus, think they are over Jesus. They think they're holding his life in their hands, when the very reverse is the case. At any moment, Jesus could have walked away, or as we've been told, called for angels to come and protect him. Now, with his turning to the women and saying to them, "Don't weep for me, weep for yourselves," it's not as if he's saying, weep for yourselves because what's going to happen to you will be worse than me. No, 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 no. I take it what he's saying is, don't weep for me because the grief and what I'm about to suffer, I've chosen. Weep for yourselves because what is about to happen to you, you have not chosen. It will come upon you. Now, I think that's what verse 31 is saying in some fashion. Look at verse 31. It is an odd sentence and it's worth just reflecting for a moment. If the people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it's dry? Now, I think what Jesus is talking about, it is debated, but I think what Jesus is talking about is he's talking about the judgments of God as kind of like a fire. And if you've ever tried to start a fire with green timber, green wood, it's very hard to make it burn. But dry wood, and I think what he's saying is the righteous judgments of God have come upon me, the green timber. I am not ripe for judgment. I am innocent. And yet I am being judged. If that happens to me by God's hand, what will happen to those who are dry, who are tender, dry, ripe and ready for the fires of judgment? And so I think Jesus is turning to the women of Jerusalem, to the people of Jerusalem, to the Jewish people and saying, you are the dry branches and you will not escape God's judgments. Weep for yourselves. Now, none of this lack of self-pity, as I say, diminishes in any way the horror of what Jesus is about to experience. Verse 33 gives it to us in very brief terms. They crucified him. Now, crucifixion, there's much in it. And you may have heard some of this before, but let me just give you a quick sense of crucifixion. A criminal who is crucified, a man who is crucified, is often kind of laid on the cross pieces and the upright and so on. And iron spikes are hammered either through the palm or the wrist, often the wrist because the palm couldn't bear the weight, it would tear out. Spikes would be often hammered through the ankles, although sometimes they were tied. We actually have the bones of a man from the first century who still has an iron spike embedded in his bones, having been brought off a cross. They would be hammered to this piece of timber and then lifted up naked in front of the people to hang on the wounds that have been inflicted upon them. And the problem then for a crucified person is that the only way to survive is obviously to keep breathing. The only way to keep breathing in that position is to lift yourself up to expand your lungs to get air into them. But the problem with lifting yourself up is that you have to either pull yourself up or push yourself up on the spikes that are embedded in your limbs. And so what happens for a crucified person is that over a period of time, the energy required to continue to push against overcomes their ability to continue to do, and so they eventually suffocate and die. It is, many people have said, the most barbaric way to execute a person ever devised. But you know what's of note here? Nothing's made of any of those details. Verse 33, we're just told they crucified him. We're not told about the spikes. We're not told about how painful it was. We're not told about any of that. We're told of much else. The point that the writer makes for us about these events focuses elsewhere. It focuses on the shame, the humiliation, the callous arrogance of people towards Jesus. They're the things that are made much of by Luke. Now, why is that? I think there's a number of reasons. But let me take you through some of it. The shame, the humiliation. It's there straight away in verse 34, the end of it, where we're told about how they divided up his clothes by casting lots. Now, that is a wonderful allusion back to Psalm 22 or a picking up of the fulfillment of Psalm 22's expectations for the righteous man's suffering. It's an extraordinary piece of evidence of God's anticipation of this event. But it is also evidence of incredible, callous, disregard. Here is Jesus, stripped bare. They've taken all his possessions, and beneath him, they are wrestling over his possessions to take them now away because he won't need them anymore. And they're doing it right in front of him, rubbing in his face the fact that his life is over and everything is taken from him. You get further the fact that Luke points out a number of different groups and their reactions to Jesus. Let me take you through these briefly. Look at verse 35, the next verse. The people stood watching. The people stood watching. Now reflect on that for a moment. This is the same people that followed Jesus from the trial, very likely the same people who called for his crucifixion. And this people stand watching. Now, that can sound kind of neutral. But the inactivity of the crowd is telling. Here is the one who has demonstrated himself to be the Messiah, the King, God's Son, and the crowd stands silently watching and makes no protest. The inactivity is telling. But then you've got further into verse 35, the rulers, they sneer at Jesus. They said, he saved others, let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one. If he is the great one, if he is God's Messiah, if he is the Christ, if he is the chosen one, then he ought to demonstrate his power by coming off the cross and saving himself. He can't. Look at him. The rulers sneer at him. But then picking up the same theme, the soldiers, look at verse 36, the soldiers also come up and mock Jesus. They offered him wine, vinegar and said, if you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. If you're this great one, get yourself out of this circumstance. There is also verse 39, one of the criminals who hangs there, he hurls insults at Jesus. Aren't you the Messiah? Well, save yourself and us. Show how great you are. Jesus is mocked, he is humiliated. The sign, the notice, verse 38, that's put above him is a form of terrible humiliation. This is the King of the Jews. This is Rome saying to the Jewish people, here's your king, crushed and defeated by us. Now, have you ever been humiliated? Now, this is kind of humiliating to admit, but put up your hands if you have. Yeah, come on. Who hasn't ever been humiliated? You've been to school, haven't you? Wasn't that the whole purpose of school, to take you through experience of humiliation? But it's a dreadful experience of being in a group of people, and I don't know, you misspeak, you say something out of place, you do something you shouldn't have done. And people don't forgive and let it go. They point it out. They make a mockery of it. They all laugh at you, not with you. And you are crushed by it. The feeling of humiliation is one of the worst feelings to ever endure. You just want to curl up and disappear. And the pain of it lingers with you, doesn't it? Now, some of you have had it so recently that you can still feel the taste of it. That it's there, it keeps you awake. It's a dreadful to be publicly ridiculed and humiliated. Now, I'm not suggesting that our experiences of humiliation are anything like what happened to Jesus. And I'm not suggesting either that crucifixion is not as bad as being humiliated. But why does Luke make much of the humiliation of Jesus? Well, I want to suggest he wants to draw to our attention how horrific it is when you understand who it is. Here is the Lord of the universe, God the giver of life, the one who has given us everything we experienced and enjoyed. Here is the one who has made all the people in front of him. Here is the one, God himself, being treated with such disregard, disdain, being mocked. And there is incredible injustice that's totally incomprehensible that's in it. I mentioned to you the repeated phrase, the repeated idea of he saved others, let him save himself. If he's the Messiah, why doesn't he save himself? If he's so great and powerful, why doesn't he save himself? Now, can you feel the grief of those words if you were Jesus? The very reason Jesus doesn't come off the cross is because he's the great Messiah. The very reason he doesn't save himself is because he is the great and mighty and glorious Saviour. And so he is there because he is so powerful that he is prepared to endure all that he endures, including the mockery. Do you see the horror of what's being said to Jesus? The reason he doesn't come off the cross is because it's only by staying there that those very people who are mocking him have an opportunity to be forgiven. So the very mockery, if he was to respond to it, would ruin their ever having an opportunity of being cleansed and forgiven from their mockery. And so Jesus, in his greatness and glory, bears with it the shame and the horror. In a moment, I want to give you some reflections the New Testament has on the cross. There's kind of four or five of them I want to share with you, but I do want to anticipate one of them now and repeat it in a moment. And I want to do it because it's just so wonderfully, powerfully important. This scene, the cross of Jesus, was planned by God from eternity past. And he is the one that's in control of it all, has destined that it all happened for a purpose. And centuries before it happened, he wanted us to know that he was in control of it. And the way he wanted us to make sure we were aware that he was in control of it was he gave us pictures of an event that would come so that when it came, we'd know what was happening. I've drawn your attention to that principle before. And I want to take you to one very famous passage. You see it in Psalm 22, which was Sarah read for us. But I want to show you one passage that all Christians must know about. Some of you already do. But come with me to Isaiah 53. And I want you to come back there and I want you to read it with me carefully. Keep your finger in Luke 23. Now I'm going to read a chunk from Isaiah 53, a passage that was written 700 years before Jesus. And it was written about a person identified as the servant of God. The one servant who will come. And I want you to see chapter 53, verse 7, what is said. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he didn't open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, yet who of his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. Now, I don't know if you noticed as I read through how many connections there are to the actual event that this anticipates. Just come backwards with me. Look at verse 12. He was numbered with the transgressors. It's deliberately, God anticipates the servant who will die among the transgressors with the criminals on either side of him. He is assigned, verse 9, a grave with the wicked. He is assigned a place of death with the criminals. and with the rich in his death. We'll see in a few weeks' time, he's actually given away the grave of a rich man. He is the one, verse 7, who was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he didn't open his mouth. Now, Jesus opened his mouth, but he opened his mouth only to speak grace, forgiveness. Like a sheep, like a lamb, meekly, he gave himself up to the will of those who desired to kill him. It's an extraordinary anticipation of this wondrous event that also gives us why it happened. Why does it happen? Verse 10, it was the Lord's will to crush him, to make his life an offering for sin. And most famously in verse 5, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed. This servant will be the one who saves the sinners. By his own self-sacrificial death, he will justify many. And it's the Lord's will that this be the case, because it's the Lord's will in grace and mercy to save sinners. You know, it's a glorious and gory event. It's gory. The death of Jesus on the cross is horrendous, but it's glorious because it's the King of the universe voluntarily submitting to this suffering out of obedience to his Father's will, whose will was to bring glory to himself in the gracious salvation of those that don't deserve it. And the Father sent the Son to reconcile the world to himself, and the Son willingly submitted to that will of his Father. It's a glorious event. Now, there are small moments of sanity in the midst of it all. Come back to Luke 23. The other criminal, you'll notice, doesn't hurl insults. Perhaps began to, but changed his tune and actually turns to Jesus, verse 42, and says, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." He throws himself onto the mercy of Jesus. He doesn't know all the mechanics, but he knows that Jesus is the key. And in his own Jewish conception of things, no doubt he was imagining that when the resurrection came at the end of history, he would be raised with Jesus, the King. Jesus gives him these wonderful words, verse 43, "Truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise. You won't have to wait for the end of history. It will be yours at the end of this day. Because upon death, I declare to you as the Lord of life, as the judge of the living and the dead, you'll be with me in heaven." Now, I think right there is evidence that there is a life between our death and the return of Christ where we're consciously with God and Jesus. Some disagree with that and kind of hold to a view called soul sleep, but my view is that upon death, we are ushered consciously into the presence of the Lord Jesus with the Father to await his return and the reception of our resurrection bodies. We are immediately upon death comforted and taken into paradise with God the Father. Friends, there is the event. We'll come next week to the actual death of Jesus and be here for it as we are week by week looking at these things. But let me give you some observations about how the New Testament reflects on this glorious and gory event. The New Testament talks a lot about the cross of Christ. I'm going to give you just five reflections, and they go fairly quickly. The first one is this. One of the ways the New Testament reflects on the cross of Christ is in 1 Peter chapter 2 and 3, where it identifies for us that the death of Jesus is for us an example on how we should live. Jesus did not go the way he wanted. He submitted his will to the Father. "Not my will, but yours." And he embraced the cross. That is the essence of going the way of Christ. It's to walk in the will of the Father, not my will. And I just quickly want to say to you, what is it to become a Christian? To become a Christian, in essence, is to say, Lord, I'm sorry for having lived my life without reference to you, without regard to you, running it my own way. I want now to have you run my life. It's what it is to become a Christian, Christ person, a follower of Christ. And more, to become a follower of Christ is to be someone who now chooses to live the way Jesus lived, submitting to the will of his Father, and not being a rights-based person. Not being a person who's always fighting for their rights. See, what is the example Jesus leaves for us? He submits to his Father's will out of love for his Father and salvation for others, and he bears the injustice that comes against him. He doesn't retaliate. He bears the injustice, and he entrusts himself to the judgments of the Father to set things right. And Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2 and 3 that, brothers and sisters, that's how you ought to live. We are to be people who are slow to retaliate all the time. And it is a great grief to me when I see Christians, and I see it in my own life, I'm not innocent of this, but it's a great grief to me when I see Christians who are too quick with the comeback to cut someone else down. Who are always wanting to be on top and hit back. Now, there is a time to stand up. There is a time to stand up. And knowing, having the wisdom to know when it's right to and when it's not, that's a great challenge as Christians, as God's people. In marriage, wives, there are times when you need to take a stand and not simply be the doormat. Don't ever be the doormat. What we're talking about here doesn't mean license for having a man crush you. There are times out of love for him you do need to say enough. Here's a boundary. Here's where I want our relationship to go, in the context of holding out a hand that says, I want our relationship to flourish and grow. Men, likewise. But learn not to be the couple that snipe at each other, always fighting for your place and position. Wrestling with that mix is an important challenge together. But to be that in all your friendships and relationships, to not be the one that is always sniping and fighting back. Sometimes you need to. You've heard that. Just don't make it the pattern. It's the way the Lord Jesus went. Second reflection the New Testament gives is, I want to suggest, the biggest central one, of course. It's the reflection of salvation. The death of Jesus wasn't just an example for us on how we should live. Jesus achieved something in the cross. He achieved salvation. He came to seek and save the lost. And the New Testament has this deep and full reflection on the work of Jesus on the cross, where he died as a substitute. He died as under the judgment of God in our place. He, the righteous one, died for the unrighteous to bring you to God. 1 Peter chapter 3. He who knew no sin became sin for us in our place, 2 Corinthians chapter 5. The curse of the law was placed upon him that the curse might not come upon us, Galatians chapter 3, verse 13. All of these are allusions, of course, back to Isaiah 53, where Jesus is numbered among the transgressions. He is led like a lamb to the slaughter, so that by his wounds we can be healed. And this is the core, this is the wonderful message of the Christian gospel. That you have had one suffer in your place so that you can be right with God. You can be forgiven. From whatever you've done, you can be forgiven. Cleansed, purified, made right. Able to stand tall before the God of the universe because of the merits of another. Because of what he's done, I no longer need to cringe. I can actually stand as a son, as a daughter of God, the King of the universe. Not because I'm better, but because my Lord Jesus has paid the price for me. And so on the confidence of his price, I can stand with confidence. Do you know that confidence? The third reflection. First reflection, the example of the cross. The second reflection, the salvation it wins for us. The third reflection, the need for our salvation. In the event of the cross, you see the Jewish people rising up against their God and killing him. You see the Gentile people in the Romans rising up against their God and killing him. And what you get in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 2, is the Apostle Peter reflecting back on the event of the cross and seeing it as the fulfillment of all of humanity's rebellion against God coming to a flashpoint. All of humanity's casting off God and disregarding God coming to its heightened flashpoint where we actually, when he arrives, kill him. And so what the New Testament sees in the cross of Christ is all humanity implicated in our guilt. Now, you may not have descended into violence against God, but rebellion takes many forms. The quiet, polite form of complacency, apathy, and disregard is killing your God. Now, you didn't nail the nail in, but to disregard your Maker is to cast him off. It's to be the crowd that stands silently and lets him be crucified. We are all guilty. And we need forgiveness and salvation, which has been won for us by the very death of Jesus. Fourth reflection. What you see here is evidence of the wonderful humility of God, who allows himself to suffer like this. Who's not too proud to suffer the injustice. There's greatness. It's not the go girl, you stand up. The go guy, I don't know if we say that to men, but it's not the you stand up and be. That's not where greatness is found. Greatness is found in humility, the readiness to even be wronged for the sake of others. Not just to be a doormat, I'm not saying that, but to allow yourself to be wronged out of love for others. That's greatness. And we see that in our God, whose love of his world caused him to give up his son to die for us. God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still enemies, Christ died for us. Fifth and final reflection. The cross of Christ demonstrates the kind of God we have that silences all the complaints people have about God. Now, I'm going to give you this observation from an extended reading from a book that's ancient that I had when I was first converted. So that's like 100 years ago or something. But let me read. It's a long reading. Settle in. At the end of time, billions of people were scattered on a great plain before God's throne. Most shrank back from the brilliant light before them, but some groups near the front talked heatedly, not with cringing shame, but with belligerence. "Can God judge us? How can he know about suffering?" snapped a pert young brunette. She ripped open a sleeve to reveal a tattooed number from a Nazi concentration camp. "We endured terror, beatings, torture, and death." In another group, a Negro boy lowered his collar. "What about this?" he demanded, showing an ugly rope burn. "Lynched for no crime but being black." In another group, a pregnant schoolgirl with sullen eyes. "Why should I suffer?" she said. "It wasn't my fault." Far out across the plain were hundreds of such groups. Each had a complaint against God for the evil and suffering he permitted in his world. How lucky God was to live in heaven where all was sweetness and light, where there was no weeping or fear, nor hatred or hunger. What did God know of all that men had to endure in this world? "For God leads a sheltered life," they said. So each of these groups sent forth their leader, chosen because he had suffered the most, a Jew, a Negro, a person from Hiroshima, a horribly deformed, arthritic, a thalamidoid child. In the centre of the plain, they consulted with each other. At last, they were ready to present their case. It was rather clever. Before God could be qualified to be their judge, he must endure what they had endured. Their decision was that God should be sentenced to life on earth as a man. Let him be born a Jew. Let the legitimacy of his birth be doubted. Give him a work so difficult that even his family will think him out of his mind when he tries to do it. Let him be betrayed by his closest friends. Let him face false charges, be tried by a prejudiced jury, convicted by a cowardly judge. Let him be tortured. At last, let him see what it means to be terribly alone. Then let him die. Let him die so that there can be no doubt he died. Let there be a great host of witnesses to verify it. As each leader announced his portion of the sentence, loud murmurs of approval went up from the throng of people assembled. When the last had finished pronouncing sentence, there was a long silence. No one uttered another word. No one moved. For suddenly, all knew that God had already served his sentence in the death of Jesus. Our God is not aloof, and it is such a grief to see our world speak of God so flippantly and with such mockery, when the real God who exists, has entered our world like this and has suffered not just all that we have suffered, but suffered in our place, bearing our guilt and shame on himself, so that we could be rescued from a world that is so broken. When you see the cross, you don't just see the physical nails and the laboured breath. You see the humiliation, the mockery, the rejection, the posture of the world that is against him, the posture of the world that he made against him. And you still see it today. And you sometimes see it in ourselves. And I want to urge you tonight to confess your sin, to confess how we have failed to appreciate the greatness and glory and goodness of our God, who has paid such a price, who has loved us so much, who is not just a set of theories or a bunch of laws or ideas, but a person who has entered our world and suffered like this for you, to bring you back to himself, such as his love. Do not treat it with contempt. Don't treat it with apathy. Turn back, and turn back knowing you will find mercy, because your God has paid for your sin at such a price. He is a God who is full of mercy, who is a Saviour. I want to say to you tonight that you cannot leave this place thinking the world is the same. Our world has had this happen to it. It is forever different. It is a place we have been, a place where God has visited and God has died, that you might be right with him.